Good morning to everybody. Thank you for coming. Ready for a little Proverbs today? I hope so, because that's what we're going to do today. We will have a little bonus Isaiah coverage. And for Frank, we will toss in a little bonus Hebrews coverage. But we will do mostly Proverbs. We're going to finish up the introductory section of Proverbs by studying chapters 8 and 9. This first 9 chapters is kind of a general discussion of spiritual wisdom and the qualities involved in spiritual wisdom and how to obtain spiritual wisdom and things like that before we get to the actual Proverbs that Solomon wrote, the little pithy sayings that take up most of the rest of the book after that. So for today, we're going to look at chapter 8 and 9. The idea is that wisdom has set her table. God has made his wisdom available to everybody. He has made it freely available to everyone who's interested in it. And wisdom is often portrayed, as we'll see again in chapter 9, as this wise woman who is just seeking people who are interested in what she has to offer. And so that's kind of the climax of the passage today. I was warned or alerted or tipped off that Proverbs chapter 8 is Karen's favorite chapter in the Bible. So that really puts the pressure on. You know, it's like you're going to stand up to sing or act or something like that, and someone says, "Don Corleone expects a good performance out of you tonight." It's nice to know that you have an important fan, but you really don't want to let your fan down here. So if I'm not back next week, you'll know Karen was not happy with the way that I handled her favorite passage. Karen is somebody I always make sure to please and satisfy. It comes from the fact that she spends a lot of time hanging around Norma, so that's where she gets those qualities. Gibran is going to go ahead and lead us in a short time of prayer to get ready to study, and then we'll do some Hebrews.
Okay, Lord God, we love you. We thank you. We need you. We thank you for today. We thank you for yesterday, for all the blessings that you do you give us, and all the things that you do, Lord God. We also ask to bless the ministry, bless Mark and Tiffany, and bless our hearing and understanding.
Amen. Thank you very much. And I was further tipped off to the part of the chapter that Karen especially likes, so we're not going to keep her in too much suspense. The first part of the chapter here kind of recaps some general lessons, although it adds a new dimension. So we're going to skim this part a little bit and spend a little more time in the last part of the chapter. Chapter 8 of Proverbs, the beginning of the chapter, does not wisdom call out? Does not understanding raise her voice? On the heights along the way where the paths meet, she takes her stand besides the gates leading to the city. At the entrances, she cries aloud, "To you, O men, I call out, I raise my voice to all mankind." And there's something of a mixed metaphor here. If you look at this passage here, and this first part here, Proverbs 8, 1 to 21, it's kind of just depicts wisdom waiting at the entrance. Wisdom calling out, making her wisdom known to everybody in a variety of different ways. Take a look at those first four verses, and it kind of depicts Lady Wisdom or the woman of wisdom calling aloud. Where is she at here? Where exactly is she described as being?
Beside the gates of the town.
Okay, beside the gates. At the front of the town. Any place else? Okay, the entrance.
Off
right, from the heights, from the hills. I think there's one other one in there.
At the
crossroads. Yeah, very good, very good. Now, can you do all of those things simultaneously? No. In other words, it's what you call, or what my mother, the English teacher, would call a mixed metaphor. It's kind of chopping together a lot of different imagery and presenting her as doing all these things at once. She's beside the gate, she's at the entrance, she's up on the hills, and she's at the crossroads. Well, what do you think this is trying to tell us?
She's just
everywhere. She's offering wisdom and guidance and spiritual understanding every place, every time, everybody.
She's not actually in the city.
Maybe not. I'm not sure about that. Now, that's an interesting postmodernist commentary right there. The idea that it's giving, however, is to help us to see that She's not limited to one time and place. You don't have to meet her at the crossroads. If you can't get to the crossroads, that's fine, because she'll meet you up on the hills. If you can't get up to the hills, that's fine too, because she'll meet you at the gates. In other words, God is very happy to offer his wisdom to anyone who wants it. There's no charge for it. It's offered to all humanity. And this is an important quality of God's wisdom that we often misunderstand. We think that we've got to go to a certain place or pay some money or have a certain wise scholar teach us all these things. And in fact, God has always wanted to know you personally. And so he wants to communicate his wisdom to you personally. The next basic characteristic it reviews here, and starting in verse 5, you who are simple gain prudence. You who are foolish gain understanding. Listen, for I have worthy things to say. I open my lips to speak what is right. My mouth speaks what is true, for my lips detest wickedness. All the words of my mouth are just. None of them is crooked or perverse. So wisdom, besides calling aloud to everyone, here in verse 5 to 11, we noted that wisdom is generous, offering herself to everyone. And now we see that she's also sincere. She's godly wisdom. Look at the words that it uses. You're truthful, straightforward, no deceit. Just telling you the truth right the way it is, without trying to cover it up, without trying to hype it, without trying to manipulate you in any way. Just tell you exactly the way things are. And it's really human nature to not do things that way. We're so used to advertisers and politicians and celebrities and everybody else trying to package their little product or point of view or whatever it is and sell it to us and try to make it look as good as possible. It's kind of part and parcel of our bourgeois society that is based on these people competing with each other for everything that the worldly value. When there's an important issue to be discussed, you get a couple of lawyers together and they argue it out, and neither one of them has any interest in the truth. They just try to present their case. And in the church, we tend, unfortunately, to adopt that same mentality. We tend to think in terms of presenting Christianity in a light that people will buy. How do you get people to do this? How do you get people to respond? How do we get our members to do this thing that we feel emotionally they should be doing, instead of just teaching the truth the way it is? Here's God. He wants to know you. He wants to know everybody. He is gracious. He is loving. He is also very righteous. So we have this sin that we have to deal with. And it's just so much human nature that we adopt it right into the church. We see the way the world does things, and we adopt it. Instead of just teaching the truth about God and letting people respond and trusting God to teach them the things they need to know, we feel we've got to prepackage it. And of course, the obvious group of individuals to joke about in this respect is politicians, because they do that all the time. And some of them are so fixated on trying to peddle their own little point of view that they just end up not even being able to think that there's another point of view out there. I read a story once about one of our former presidents, Richard Nixon, who is, to put it generously, one of the most unusual individuals that our fellow citizens have ever chosen to lead our nation. He was actually a very highly intelligent man, but he had a lot of personality problems, a lot of emotional issues. He was a very paranoid person, and he was a classic politician who wanted people only to hear his side of it. He always was very paranoid about people saying things about him that he didn't think were true. And I read some memoirs by one of his aides, a guy called Lynn Knopfziger, that if you're as old as me, you might remember him. He was hanging around in the White House then. And he wrote a lot of interesting things about working for Nixon. But the story that stuck in my mind was so entertaining was, he said there was one time that he saw Richard Nixon laugh. And it was an occasion when this guy, this assistant of his, Knopfziger, was supposed to go and meet with some people from the media and some people from Congress. And Nixon, as usual, was really worried about what they were going to say. And he says to Knopfziger, "Now, don't let them get away with any lies." And Knopfziger says, "Don't worry, Mr. President. I won't even let them get away with the truth." And he said Nixon actually had the self-awareness to burst out laughing, because he understood that that's what he was trying to do. That's exactly what he was trying to do. He wasn't really worried about getting away with lies. He was worried about the truth coming out. And the reason why I mention that is because this, unfortunately, is the way that Christians can be sometimes. Sometimes we're so worried about the false things out there, and in our minds, we convince ourselves, we don't want people to hear any lies about God. But what we're really trying to cover up is the truth. what we're really trying to cover up is the truth that we really don't have the answers here. What we're doing is we're just kind of struggling along just like anybody else. And the truth is that God loves everybody out there whether we approve of them or not. What we're really fighting against sometimes is the truth when we get all paranoid and worried about what other people are saying. Spiritual wisdom doesn't worry about having competition or rivals. Spiritual wisdom is not worried about people hearing lies, because it's part of the responsibility that God gives everyone is to seek the truth amidst the lies. And this is what Lady Wisdom says next here in verse 10. Choose my instruction instead of silver, knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is more precious than rubies. Nothing you desire can compare with her. That's the lasting value. The real treasure is in God's wisdom. And it's not only up to you to seek that, it's also up to everyone else to seek that for themselves. And the thing that we need to do for each other is not to try to sell God's wisdom or sell the gospel like a commercial product, but it's to just tell people the truth. Here is what it is. We all need our sins forgiven. We're all under a burden of sin. We have to accept it by grace. We can't earn it. We spend the rest of our lives showing our gratitude to God. That's not something that would come out of a marketing department or a focus group. That would only come from the heart of God Himself. And that's really what we should be doing. And so the next little section here, we'll just skim it. It talks about how, verse 14, counsel and sound judgment are mine. I have understanding and power. By me kings reign and rulers make laws that are just. By me princes govern and all nobles who rule on earth. I love those who love me, and those who seek me find me. With me are riches and honor, enduring wealth and prosperity. My fruit is better than fine gold. What I yield surpasses fine silver. And it's some interesting things that it talks about, because it's really talking about in that passage that spiritual wisdom brings spiritual blessings. On the one hand, she says, wisdom says, I have riches and wealth for you. But then what does she turn around and say about them? What kind of wealth and treasure are they? She compares them with gold. She says, it's better than gold or silver. I'm not offering you gold or silver. Remember that story in Acts where Peter meets the blind man. Silver or gold I don't have, but what I have I give you. That's really what she's saying right there. If you're in it for the money, well, I've got things that are better than money. And that's something that we should try to understand. And here again, she is being honest. Wisdom is being honest. That this is not the attraction that God's offering us. God will give you all the things that you need. God gives us all the things that we need, but He also is not going to try to overwhelm us with material things to the exclusion of spiritual blessings that are even more important. God is very generous. He's given us a lot of things, and He has given us treasure that we even don't need. We have a lot more than we need in this world. The problem is that people in the world are so much more interested in the worldly treasures that instead of just realizing, hey, we all got more than we need, what do? They fight over it, and they argue about it, and they battle with each other about it. And one of the things about God's treasure is that it doesn't come with a price tag. See, our human minds, we always want to put a price tag on everything. Anything that comes up, everyone always wants, how much does it cost? What's it worth? I have a lot of little memorabilia for baseball cards and programs and everything like that, and occasionally I'll show one to someone, and the first question people all want to, how much is it worth? Well, most of my favorite baseball cards are probably worth about 15, 20 cents. You know, I don't keep them because it's what they're worth. It's because they're guys I saw playing when I was a kid and I enjoyed it. They weren't even that great of players. I have the cards because I like that connection with a guy I saw play when I was a kid. I don't care what it's worth. My wife probably cares what it's worth because she's warned me that if I die before she does, she's going to sell all my baseball cards. So she probably cares what they're worth. I don't care what they're worth. I've got programs from all kind of ball games that I've gone to over the years, and they're not worth anything. They weren't worth anything when I bought it. It doesn't matter. I save it because I was at a game that I enjoyed, and I want to save it as a little memento. Well, God's wisdom doesn't have a price tag. And it's important for us to try to recondition our little bourgeois minds to try to get past that goal of putting the worldly price tag and the worldly cost-benefit analysis on it. As Isaiah said in Isaiah 1:18, this is one of Angela's favorite scriptures. I just do this out of grace. Angela would never harm me or anything, even if she was not happy, but I like making Angela happy. Isaiah 1:18, come, let us reason together. God simply says, here is the way it is. Here are the things that I have to offer you. And then it talks about, in this passage, it talks about everyone from kings to slaves, educated to uneducated in the world of the eyes. Everybody can use this spiritual wisdom. It's useful for everybody. It is useful for guidance and counsel. Now, counsel and guidance are not the same as nagging. So what we tend to do with spiritual teachings is not to counsel people, but to nag people with it. You should be doing this. I think you ought to be doing that. I think you ought to go over there. Why didn't you do it that way? I would have done it this way. That's not counsel and guidance. Counsel and guidance is simply telling the truth about God and about human nature and then letting other people make up their own minds. Now, I'm well aware that you certainly know people. You probably know several persons that if they would just listen to your advice more often, they would probably mess their lives up a lot more quickly than if they ignored you. But sometimes it's best to let them mess their lives up at their own pace instead of speeding it along with your advice. We just should give people counsel, remind them about God's nature, remind them about what God values, what's truly important, help one another to slowly pull out of this worldly thinking that's been instilled in us. Okay, we're going to move on now. Karen's been very patient. I see her start tapping her toe there. We're going to get to the part that Karen really likes out of Proverbs 8. And in fact, this is a glorious passage, a lot of wonderful things that tie together. Would you like to read this whole passage, Karen, or should...
Huh?
All righty. So read from verse 22 and then go to the end of the chapter. Thank you very much. Excellent reading and an excellent passage, of course, right there. And it talks about a number of things that are well worth taking note of. It talks about this idea of wisdom, and again, wisdom is being personified as this wise woman who is calling out to people, hoping that they will listen to her reason and her understanding. And here it backs up, and it has a lot of imagery here about the creation and about God to emphasize some things about the nature of God's wisdom, that God's wisdom is eternal, that there's such a difference between God's wisdom and ours that goes beyond simply that God has a bigger collection of facts than we do. God is a better calculator than we are. You know, God can whip out these differential equations even quicker than our engineers with their iPhones and everything. God can find the trivia answers even quicker than those of you who have been busy looking up the answers to the trivia. It's much different than that. It's not just saying, look, God knows a little bit more. He's got it all calculated. He's a step ahead. He's figured a couple moves ahead of you. It's that God's entire perspective and set of values and priorities is on a whole different scale. God is transcendent. God is not just better and bigger. God transcends our definition of good, our definition of wise, our definition of powerful. And these images then in this passage that we read are meant to emphasize that. If you take a look at the beginning of that, where it talks about before the world began, it says several interesting things about wisdom. He says, and I should point out that the words in this passage are kind of notoriously hard to translate accurately. And if you look in different versions, you'll see they get translated differently. And that's actually not a bad idea, because we're not meant to get focused on the literal meaning of these words. If you have an NIV, At verse 22, we'll say, the Lord brought me forth as the first of his works. There's also, if you have the older version of the NIV from back in the 70s, it will not say that. They actually changed it. It used to say, the Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, because the phrase in Hebrew is kind of ambiguous. And that's true with a lot of these terms. So you don't want to get fixated on a literal reconstruction of how exactly wisdom came into being. So when you talk about wisdom being born, the so-called birth that he's talking about, we're not meant to try to get into the technical details of that or build a speculative theology so much as to realize some general ideas. Verse 23, for example, I was appointed when?
From eternity,
from before the world began. And this great imagery here, when there were no oceans, I was given birth. Before there were any springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills. You know, we use that phrase, as old as the hills, to refer to someone like Frank Chappell, who's been around longer than any of us can remember and longer than any of our grandparents could remember.
Just certain hills,
okay. That expression actually literally comes, literally what it means is, you're as old as the hills, you were there when God made them, is what it's talking about. And wisdom has been around even longer than Frank has. Wisdom has been around since before this world began. And what it's talking about is that God himself was, he was around before everything began. He is wisdom. We know the phrase God is love. Well, you could also say God is wisdom. To God, his love is even more important than his wisdom. But what it's emphasizing here is the wisdom that he has that comes from being around from eternity. And it's some reflections of God's nature that he's emphasizing here. He's emphasizing in this passage that the wisdom was around before the world began, and that this wisdom has been included in his creation. That when God made things, he had already developed this eternal perspective. We know from the New Testament, God chose Jesus to redeem the world when? After Cain killed Abel and he realized that these people were really going to mess stuff up? After the flood, when he realized that they were messing up even worse? First century AD, he just woke up one morning, my son might like seeing what's like down there. No, when did he pick Jesus? Before the foundation of the world, before the world began. In other words, God already knew what he was going to do. He already knew that he was going to create humanity, that he was going to make us in his image, and he already knew that we'd goof things up. So he already had it in his mind, this is the way it's going to be. God was so wise that he foresaw the whole thing, not in all the specific details. That's what we always do when we get into God foreknowing things. It's, did he know the Buckeyes were going to win that game? How could I have found out? Did he know who was going to do this, that, and the other? And does that, you get into these irrelevant side debates instead of just realizing God foreknew that he was going to create humanity. God knew that he was going to make us in his image. God knew that we would sin. God knew that we would need to be redeemed. He knew we wouldn't be able to earn it on our own. And so he knew that he was going to send Jesus. And so it's woven into his creation. And what he's asking for is not for us to try to reason it out or to understand immortality or eternity, because a mortal mind can't do that. You can come up with analogies, you can come up with theology, but you really can't understand it until you yourself are made immortal someday. And so what he's asking for, or what she is asking for, is one thing. This passage is not calling for us to try to reason this out. It's calling for us to have one quality. The old Wheel of Fortune thing. Oh, I'm actually spotting you some of the vowels here. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. This is what this passage is calling for. All this imagery about the creation and about how God has an eternal perspective and wisdom's been around long before you and me and even longer than Frank, it's not saying, okay guys, there's some real fascinating little details, try to figure them out, let's see who can figure it out. It's simply saying, hey guys, be humble in God's sight. Don't get so cocksure of all your little theologies and all your little doctrines and all your little methods, because you don't know 0.1% of it. You just can't. It's not a criticism of us. It's just a truth. We really can't understand that. And so what he's calling for is humility. When we look at the creation, to be humble. Instead of just looking for things in creation to use as arguments against evolutionists, or to use as proofs of our pet theories, to be humbled by it. To realize we don't have any idea, the theologians don't have any idea. It's an incredibly complex subject. And all this imagery then, as he goes on, talks about wisdom being the craftsman at God's side. And it talks about how wisdom has been woven into the things that God created. And you pick up in verse 27, it talks about, I was there when the heavens were set in place, when the horizon was marked on the face of the deep, when he established the cloud. That when God created everything, wisdom was woven into it. What that means is that God all along knew what he was doing. He all along knew that he was going to create you and me, eternal souls, housed in what kind of a body? A mortal body. We're here in a mortal fleshly body right now. And so when he made the creation, what did he do? He wove that wisdom into the creation. Look at the creation. You see, on the one hand, the grandeur, the perfection, the beauty, the power, the overwhelming, you know, the kind of imagery that he gives here, which I think is what makes it on one of Karen's favorite scriptures right there. This great imagery of the beautiful creation. But what is also woven into this creation? Perishability, mortality, temporary nature. It's one of the few things that the theologians and the scientists agree on, is that this world had a beginning and it's going to have an end. It's one of the few things. The Bible says it had a beginning. The scientists said it had a beginning. It's going to end someday. The Bible says it's going to end, and the scientists say it's going to end. It's one of the few things they agree on. It's like one of the few times the Republicans and Democrats agree on something. It's probably a good idea if they both agree on it. And what that means is that it calls for us to be humble and to understand that that's woven into creation. There are many myriads of reminders in creation of God's power, his wisdom, and his compassion. There are also many myriads of reminders in creation that it's temporary. We're mortal. It's not going to be here forever. You're not going to be here forever. That stuff's not going to be here forever. All of our little mechanical devices and cars and buildings and wonderful things that we do, they're not going to be here forever. The creation itself's not going to be here forever. It's a physical, temporary world. And that's woven into the creation. And it calls for us to be humble about it. You look, little quote from somebody. See if you can recognize this, because this guy wrote a lot of things, but he's actually best known to most people as a writer of children's books. This guy actually, he wrote a well-known children's book that you might have read if you had anything resembling a good elementary education. He said, whenever I get sick and agonized over the things men do, all I need to do is take a few steps in another direction to see what spiders do, and it makes me feel a lot better. That's exactly right. E.B. White right there. Wrote the classic children's book, Charlotte's Web. And it's kind of a statement on creation, that you see the folly and the wickedness and the violence of humankind, but then you can always find something else out there to remind you of God. Now, E.B. White was fascinated with spiders. He just loved spiders, and he wrote this book called Charlotte's Web that was about a spider. It's one of my wife's favorite books, in fact. It's an interesting story, because it's about this farmyard, and there's a pig in this farmyard who makes friends with this little spider. And the little spider, Charlotte, which, by the way, Linda always refers to spiders as Charlotte. Yeah, I trained her not to squash spiders and centipedes, and I appealed to her scientific reasons, so she always spares them. She'll see a big spider crawling along, and she'll say, Charlotte, you'd be happier out in the garden. And occasionally she'll call up to one if it's too high for her to get. She'll say, Charlotte, Charlotte. And it always reminds me of Olivia de Havilland in the movie Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. But I think we're going to have to let that one go. That would take a while to explain. I'll let you cinephiles look that up on your own. But the story, this spider Charlotte finds out that this pig is scheduled to be slaughtered for its meat. And so to save her friend the pig, she starts writing things on her web. You know, some pig, radiant, wow, what a pig, and writes it on the web. And so everyone gets all excited. Oh, this farmer, he has this great pig. And so everyone comes to look at the pig. And the funny thing is, they all look at the pig. And there's one scene where someone says, guys are getting all excited about this pig. It seems to me we've got one unusual spider here. And no one pays attention to him. Because what does the sign say? The sign says it's the pig. The sign says it's the pig that's unusual here. Well, what is that like? The world puts up signs, too, about how awesome and incredible their products are and their ideas are, and what do? Oh, it's what the sign says. You know, you watch one of these ridiculous cable news networks with their superficial news coverage, and I apologize for those redundancies. It has a little sign on the screen, in-depth coverage. It's in-depth coverage. Oh, yeah, these opinions and these speculative theories, it's in-depth coverage. You don't ever stop to question. Sure, it's in-depth by the standards of the self-interested humans who are pushing their stuff on you to make you anxious and upset about things so that you obsessively watch their cable news channel and boost their ratings so that they can charge their advertisers more money. You don't think that far ahead, do you? Another thing E.B. White said, he says, I've occasionally had the exquisite thrill of putting my finger on a little capsule of truth and have heard it give the faint squeak of mortality under my pressure. That's the hidden, subtle truth woven into this creation, mortality, the need for humility, the need for us to connect with God on a deeper level than just our mundane daily business or our pretentious human speculations and theologies and accomplishments. The need to connect with our own mortality is woven into creation as a call for us to have wisdom about it. He also says something very else, very interesting. There is another side to this. Verse 31 talks about wisdom's attitude towards the creation. How does wisdom feel about the world God has created? Rejoicing and specifically doing what? Delighting in mankind. Delighting in humanity. And here is where we come to some very important New Testament parallels. Because when you see this image of, I was the craftsman at God's side, I helped him make all this stuff, I was creating all these things, does that remind you of any New Testament scriptures? They're written on the board here. John 3, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Through him, all things were made. And then I know this is one of Frank's favorites. It's talking about Jesus. He was... In Hebrews 1, in the past, God spoke to our forefathers at many times and in various ways, but in these last days, He's spoken to us by His Son, through whom He created the universe. In other words, this is a wonderful parallel of Jesus and of His role. And again, it's not there so that we can push it to make speculative theologies or fixate on irrelevant details, just so much as to see how consistent God's wisdom is. How from the very creation of the world, He already had this perspective that transcends the fact that He knows more than you and I do. God has never just been about facts and figures. God's always been about His compassion, His desire to have relationships. And that's what spiritual wisdom then is based on. And so wisdom says in verse 32, now then. And what it does is it emphasizes two things. That there's a promise that comes from all this. The promise that if God has gone to all this trouble in creating this world and in sending His Son, if He's gone to all this trouble, then we'd better get out there and scold some atheists, shouldn't we? That's not what He's saying. He says, if God has gone to all this trouble, when He promises you that He's going to forgive your sins, what should you do? You should trust Him. When He tells you that He wants you to go out and be gracious to other human beings, what should you do? You should believe it, that's really the way that He wants it. Well, He also knows, as is emphasized, that it's going to take some patience. It's going to take some real patience for us to learn this because we all have this colossal backlog of worldly knowledge and worldly perspectives that we've soaked up over the years. We've got this huge burden of worldly beliefs, false loyalties to earthly groups, false beliefs about God, things that have been pushed on us by the world. And so we have to learn to let that stuff go and slowly, patiently adopt the perspective and the priorities that God has given us. Not just the facts and the morality and the do this and the don't do that. Those are level zero stuff. To adopt the perspective that God has and the priority and just to try at least to make a small adjustment to this eternal perspective that He has. Chapter 9 portrays two invitations. The first part of the chapter portrays wisdom offering an invitation, and the second part of the chapter, you get an invitation from folly. We won't have time to quite read the whole thing, but we'll take note of a few important things here. Wisdom tells us that everything is ready. Wisdom has built her house. She's hewn out its seven pillars. She's prepared her meat, mixed her wine. She's also set her table. She sent out her maids, and she calls from the highest point of the city. Let all who are simple come in here, she says to those who lack judgment. Come, eat my food, drink the wine I've mixed, leave your simple ways, and you will live. Walk in the way of understanding. So everything is ready. Now, that little imagery there of, I got this feast ready. My house has been prepared, got all the food, got all the wine, got everything ready for you. Come on in. Here again, can you set connect with anything in the New Testament? Well, I got them right here if you want to peek. Yeah, there's two different parables Jesus tells of someone offering a great banquet and sending out the servants, inviting everybody. And of course, people turn it down. But there's some good parallels here because this is what God does. Everything's ready. It's open for everybody. No exclusions, no criteria, no cost. That everything is all set to go. And so wisdom is just offering. Now, an interesting difference, the one difference between these is that in Proverbs, wisdom is always portrayed as a woman. And that's an interesting parallel because it kind of brings out that God's maleness, which we know the Bible always refers to God as a he, which there's no reason why it shouldn't. But God's maleness is not a worldly kind of maleness. God is also sometimes referred to as having motherly characteristics in the New Testament. And this characteristic of wisdom is deliberately portrayed as female. You can decide if there are any biological or sociological implications of that. I'm kind of more interested in the spiritual implications, that it's just another reminder not to get too fixated on our conventional models of God. In this passage, it even emphasizes verse 3, that she has sent out her maids. It's really specifically female servants is the word in the Hebrew, and most English versions reflect that. Just to remind us that God is not a stereotypical male in charge of stuff, telling us what to do. God, it's emphasizing God's approach using reason, but not just dry logical reason, emotional reason, compassionate reason, appealing on the basis of relationship, not on the basis of command and obedience. There's a dimension to God that is far more important than command and obedience. It's the relationship and the closeness that he's calling. Well, it talks about a life of spiritual learning, verse 7 to 12. It talks about if you rebuke a mocker, he's just going to hate you. But if you rebuke a wise man, he's going to love you. If you try to teach a fool, they're just going to be annoyed by it. If you try to teach a righteous man, he will appreciate it and add to his learning. In other words, we come back to this same quality of humility. Seeking spiritual wisdom means living a life of humility, that we're always going to have a lot to learn. No matter how much you know, there's always going to be a lot more to learn. You know, even the world could benefit from that perspective. Even the world could benefit, even if they don't have any faith or love, if they just have a little bit more humility, so many problems would not be as complicated. Because an awful lot of the problems the world has come from the fact that everybody immediately thinks they got the answer to it, and they start arguing about these different kinds of silly, trivial answers instead of realizing that it's bigger than all of us. The problem of human hatred and rivalry and wars and materialism and poverty, all those things transcend little technical solutions because they all call for a different perspective, a change of heart. But it's certainly as Christians, humility is essential in understanding what God has done. And this invitation of folly at the end of the chapter is just by contrast. The woman folly is loud. She's undisciplined, without knowledge. She sits at the door of her house on the seat at the highest point of the city. Well, she's offering her invitation too, calling out to those who pass by, come on in. Stolen water is sweet and food eaten in secret is delicious. She's loud, she's crass, the stuff she's got to offer isn't very valuable, but what does she do? She kind of turns it around to disguise this and makes it into something that seems secret, sophisticated, special, a little hidden treasure here. Food eaten in secret is delicious. Stolen water is sweet. And by the way, stolen water is a euphemism for something that we covered a couple weeks ago. Look in your notes if you have forgotten this. But it's talking about how the world makes its crass little temporary rewards seem sophisticated and special instead of noting them for the temporary crass things they are. The material things and the sensual pleasures that humans crave, they package them up as if they were something really desirable and really exciting, instead of being honest about it, what God is. Now again, the unfortunate problem is we tend to try to compete with that and package Christianity and the gospel is, oh no, it's even more exciting, it's even more fun, instead of just saying, look, God's not looking for fun and excitement in the sense the world is. He's looking for something different, a deeper level of reward, a deeper level of understanding, a different kind of blessing, and a different kind of satisfaction, and a different kind of pleasant blessings that soothe the soul instead of agitating the flesh. Coming up to a little trivia question here. This is sports trivia. Try to get the sports in. I would do animal trivia every week if it were up to me, but I like sports too, and this will placate some of you who like sports. You are fans of college football, right? Okay, now if you didn't say yes, I won't report you to the authorities. I know it's a local ordinance here in Columbus, Ohio, but okay, of all the schools that play in the top level of college football, simple question, which two have the fewest students? In other words, what are the two smallest schools that compete in the top level of college football? Is it Yale and Dartmouth? Well, Yale and Dartmouth actually don't compete in the top level anymore. They were relegated some years ago. Is it Duke and Northwestern? None of the rest of these are tricks. All the rest of them actually are on the top level. Duke and Northwestern? How about Duke and Notre Dame? How about Rice and Tulsa? How about Miami of Ohio and Stanford? Well, now there's a little bonus trivia today. Before I give you the answer, President John Kennedy once said, there are three things that are real. Well, what were the three things that he said were real? And then bonus trivia, what's the connection between those two questions? So that'll keep those of you with your iPhones pretty busy. Well, to get back to the first question about the smallest schools and the top level of college football, one of the schools that's the smallest, one of the smallest schools is actually where I went as an undergraduate before I came to Ohio State to do my graduate study in math. I grew up in Ohio. I always figured I would come back to Ohio to live the rest of my life, so I wanted to go someplace far away. My parents thought it was a good idea too. Go someplace, you live someplace different, see what it's like. I actually traveled to a foreign country. I went to Rice University, which is in Texas, so I learned what it's like to live in a foreign country for a while. Texas is a weird place. I'm glad that I know about it now, and I'm glad that I don't live there anymore. I'm glad that I'm back here in the United States, where there's reasonable type of human culture, at least most of the time. Rice University, for a long time, was the smallest school in the top level of college football. The University of Tulsa actually is now, they moved up to the level, so they're actually the smallest school now. So Rice and Tulsa are the two smallest school. The second question here, the connection with the John Kennedy question, is that John Kennedy, when he was president, gave a famous speech at Rice University's football stadium. Rice University has a 70,000 foot seat football stadium, which is more than all the people who have ever attended Rice University. The reason they have it is because a long time ago, Rice used to be, and Frank remembers this, they used to be in what was called the old Southwest Conference. And every week they would play teams like Texas and Texas A&M and these big time teams. And so they had this big stadium because people from the other team would come and watch. And so they would fill up the stadium with fans of the other team. Well, it was a really nice stadium to use for other events. And so in the 60s, President Kennedy, when he announced the beginning of the Apollo moon program, that's where he announced it, in Rice Stadium, which because Houston had a lot of the work being done for the space program. And it was an interesting speech, and I actually listened to the Rice sporting broadcasts. Rice's football team usually is not that good. Their basketball team is usually awful. They have a great baseball team, though. Rice has traditionally had a real good baseball team. And through the miracle of the internet, which was invented by our wonderful beloved engineering friends, thank you so much. Your gracious act of sharing your knowledge with the world and creating the internet so I can listen to games that I otherwise would miss. I listen to Rice baseball games all the time, and they still play, just as a little promo, an excerpt from John Kennedy's speech, because he has a line in that speech. He's trying to explain, okay, why with all the other problems in the world, why would we want to send men to the moon? Some people want us to do the easy things. Well, I say as a nation we should learn to do the hard things. Why should we try to stamp out poverty? Because it's hard, not because it's easy. And he gave some other examples, and he said, why does Rice play Texas in football every year? It's not because it's easy, it's because it's a challenge. And that was his way of promoting, we should try to go to the moon because it's hard, because it's going to be a challenge, because it's something that can pull us together. And so that's the connection with John Kennedy. And this kind of connection with spiritual wisdom, that it's not easy. We're not asking people to follow God because it's easy. It's because it's a challenge. It's because it calls us to rise above this complacent bourgeois worldly mentality that's been drummed into us and see things in a different way. But it's not painful either. If you just get rid of all the worldly baggage, it actually frees you up from a lot of this angst and a lot of the anger and bitterness that the world can raise any second just by appealing to your little prejudices and your little false loyalties. It's actually a positive thing. John Kennedy actually said, also said something else that I actually like it even better. This is this other bonus trivia quote. He said once, there are three things in life that are real: God, human folly, and laughter. And then he said, and since the first two are unfathomable, let's make the best we can of the third one. And you know, in a sense, that's what the book of Proverbs is about, isn't it? Exactly what President Kennedy said. There are three things that really exist no matter what. There's God, and then there's our folly, and then there's laughter. And you know, the book of Proverbs really is a kind of humorous book in a lot of ways, the way it points out all our little faults. It's a gentle way of trying to help us see things. Seeking spiritual wisdom, this is a point that I want to leave you with. Seeking spiritual wisdom is a challenge. It's a call to rise above the flesh. But it's not unpleasant once you get used to the idea. It is amusing to look at ourselves if we just drop our pride, if we just drop how seriously we take ourselves as individuals and as a church and look at it honestly. It's funny. It's amusing. And we can learn a lot of things and help each other in a loving, compassionate way that it doesn't have to be confronting and challenging and rebuking. All that stuff that the flesh revels in because it's just another form of competition. Spiritual wisdom is something we can share together very gently, very kindly, not having to compete, not having to force, not having to manipulate or coerce, but just to slowly reveal God's true nature to one another. So I hope you think about those things. We'll pick up with some more Proverbs next week.